is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. On Monday, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman met with Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister in Geneva. The talks came as roughly 100,000 Russian troops are stationed near the country's border with Ukraine. It's a threatening and growing military presence, mirrored by a diplomatic stalemate. Vladimir Putin specializes in aggressive posturing, and this most recent crisis is no different. Deadlocking talks with demands described as non-starters, including a demand that Ukraine must be prevented from ever joining NATO. Here's what Deputy Secretary Sherman had to say after Monday's discussions.
We will not forego bilateral cooperation with sovereign states that wish to work with the United States. And we will not make decisions about Ukraine without Ukraine, about Europe without Europe, or about NATO without NATO.
These developments are only the latest chapter in this long Russian novel, a saga that included former President Donald Trump as a central character when, back in 2019, the Trump administration withheld hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid to Ukraine that the nation planned to use to protect against further military aggression from Russia. It was a move that led to the first impeachment of President Trump.
The questions presented by this impeachment inquiry are whether President Trump sought to exploit that ally's vulnerability and invite Ukraine's interference in our elections, whether President Trump sought to condition official acts, such as a White House meeting or U.S. military assistance, on Ukraine's willingness to assist with two political investigations that would help his reelection campaign.
That was Representative Adam Schiff, who led the 2019 impeachment investigation. Under President Biden, Representative Schiff has continued in his role as chair of the House Intelligence Committee, remained outspoken on the threat that Russia poses to Ukraine's independence, and joined the House committee that is investigating the causes of the January 6th Capitol insurrection. I spoke to Representative Schiff on Monday, and there was no shortage of topics for us to address. He began by telling me about when the January 6th committee might hold its next public hearings.
I would expect that we would begin them, I hope, within a matter of weeks. Our first hearing, which we had some months ago with the four police officers, I think was enormously powerful and did exactly what you mentioned, which is it helped to puncture some of the efforts at revisionist history. Those that are trying to portray January 6th now as a normal tourist day, when they watched that hearing and they heard the vivid testimony of those police officers, they saw the video of what they experienced, the degree to which they were being crushed in a door or gouged or beaten or pepper sprayed. I think it really had a visceral impact on people who were watching. So we realized the importance of bringing the country along with us and showing them the progress that we're making. We're making a lot of progress. At the same time, one of the reasons that we have waited is we want to make sure that we don't, through public hearings, reveal information that would hamper our further investigation or inform witnesses what we know or don't know at a particular stage in the investigation. But I think we're reaching at the point now where we have gathered sufficient information that we can begin to hold those public hearings without being too concerned about its impact on other witnesses.
Are you expecting former President Trump to testify under oath?
We haven't made a decision about that. Normally, in an investigation, you would save, you know, the highest profile, the most significant witnesses towards the end. You realize if you even get one crack at them, you'll only get one crack at them. So you want to make sure that you're fully prepared and know all the questions you want to ask and have all the facts at your disposal. You know, for that reason, I would think we'll make a decision on him towards the end of the investigation. At the same time, we're mindful that you know, he successfully strung along Bob Mueller endlessly and ultimately such that he was able to thwart Mueller's ability to interview him. So we're mindful of Trump's precedent for delay and obfuscation.
I really do want to dig in here just a bit because when you talk again about misleading information, when you talk about the need to sort of again puncture this, as we saw with those very powerful testimonies with the Capitol Police, I'm wondering how you think about the issue of intelligence, particularly on the global stage, for American decision-making, in a time when there is so little trust and when things that appear to be sort of uncontested facts nonetheless become contested and partisan in the public sphere.
It's a really good question, and it has so many dimensions to it. If you take, for example, you know, what the administration has been discussing publicly, which is, you know, some of our intelligence on the Russian troop buildup in Ukraine, when the former president disparaged U.S. intelligence agencies, it undermines our credibility when we say, hey, this is what the Russians are doing. They're preparing an invasion of Ukraine. Or when we say, hey, the Russians are interfering in our elections again, we need those agencies to have credibility. They do extraordinary work. And so the last 4 years of politicization of the agencies, of disparagement by Donald Trump, was really a body blow to our national security. So we depend on them. At the same time, as policymakers, we need to know the limits of intelligence. We saw the limits of intelligence with the lead up to the Iraq War. Now, part of that was intelligence, and part of that was hyping the intelligence that we had. And so we see both the perils of the limits of good intelligence, but also the perils of hyping intelligence or politicizing it. It, you know, used properly can be an enormously important tool for policymakers to give us the best insights possible into what's happening around the world. But in those rare occasions where the President of the United States needs to make use, or Congress needs to make use of that intelligence publicly to make the case for something, then it's really important that the public have confidence in it. And that's very difficult when for years now, the last administration was denigrating both the intelligence agencies and the FBI because it has really eroded trust in their abilities.
I want to go back. You name-checked what's happening between Russia and Ukraine at this time. How is the administration managing this? And do you think that sanctions are enough to dissuade and punish Russia for its actions against Ukraine?
I think the administration is doing all that it can. Whether it will be successful, you know, time will tell. Putin may very well invade regardless of what we do. Sanctions are one of the few tools that we have that are short of using military force and apart from diplomacy or integral to diplomacy, but they don't always succeed. And indeed, sanctions have a pretty, we have to be circumspect about their track record, because much of the time they have not succeeded in meeting their objective. But they can help a diplomatic effort. I think the pressure from sanctions was enough initially to bring Iran to the table to enter into that original nuclear deal. And it's possible that sanctions now, if they're clear enough to Russia in advance, if they're substantial enough, if we have enough uniformity with our allies, may be enough of a deterrent. But the reality is, we're not going to go to war with Russia, and so we have to use the tools that we can. Diplomacy and sanctions are among the tools that we have. And I am encouraged that there seems to be a growing level of support around the world for very punitive sanctions on Russia, and growing support in NATO to reposition NATO assets closer to Russia, not farther away, if they invade, signaling to Russia that they will not achieve their objective if their objective is to roll back NATO. I think it's also important that we telegraph that we're prepared to supply Ukraine with weapons to defend itself and to make it costly for Russia. That's the most I think we can do, but it may or may not be enough.
I want to pop back from the international and global and back to the not only the domestic, but the household, the kind of kitchen table economics, and particularly the issue of student loans. The student loan moratorium is extended to May 1st. You have been very much on this issue. I'm wondering sort of where you stand now. And each time the moratorium is extended, social media will certainly take to task this idea that, in fact, there is a capacity, perhaps a greater capacity, to eliminate at least substantial portions of this debt?
I think there is that capacity, and I support forgiving a significant portion of that debt. These moratoriums are good. They're helpful for people who are still struggling because of the pandemic, but that debt is still there. And that debt is just crushing for so many millions of students and former students. it limits their career choices. Many can't follow what they would really love to do because they won't be able to afford to pay their loans back. And it just puts a real, I think, limit and damper on our young people's future. And given, you know, the wealth that we have in this country, we don't need to saddle our young people with that burden. I favor aggressive action by the Congress. I certainly encourage the Biden administration to, on its own, through executive order, do as much as it can to forgive student debt. We have to find a way to make that equitable. I think it ought to be a really, really high priority.
You know, you've talked in part, for example, if we go back to the January 6th commission, about the need to do some things in private and also in public, right? This need to ultimately have the public hearings, but also sometimes to operate in ways that don't immediately bring in the public so efforts can move forward to move towards justice. And I'm wondering, in your time in the U.S. Congress and as you look at our current political environment, if you think we've struck the right balance between that disinfectant that is sunlight, allowing the public to see what is going on, but also the need sometimes to be behind closed doors to make some of these deals, decisions, compromises in order to protect from some of the highly partisan and highly charged opinions that are that can potentially keep members from maybe making the best policy choices.
I think we've struck the right balance in the investigations that I've been involved in. You know, to give you an example, the Ukraine investigation, we did the interviews and depositions in closed session so that witnesses couldn't tailor their testimony to one another or figure out the limits of what we knew and then not tell us anything we didn't already know. But then immediately thereafter, we pivoted to public hearings, which I think were very impactful and very important. And that sequencing, I think, really worked in the Ukraine investigation. I think it is working properly in the January 6th investigation. The concern with going public too early is less one of it causing partisanship among the members. You know, in terms of the Intel Committee and our Russia investigation, Ukraine investigation, that partisanship was already there. And it was less partisanship than, frankly, Republican members deciding to be defense lawyers for Donald Trump. That wasn't a partisan decision so much as in my view, sort of a cult around one person decision. It's less, though, about that than it is about not compromising the investigation. You know, we had witnesses, for example, in the Ukraine investigation, you'll remember, like Gordon Sondland, who came in behind closed doors and told us one thing because he didn't think we would know any better. And then further information came out and he realized that he was exposed to potential perjury. And for witnesses to know that if they're not truthful when they testify, that they could be prosecuted for perjury, and some of those in the Russia investigation were prosecuted for perjury, tends to get them more likely to tell the truth. And that's more of the overriding consideration than it is whether doing things in open session will prompt members to be partisan. The last thing I'll say on this subject is, ironically, given the seriousness of the subject matter, the January 6th committee is probably the least partisan committee on the Hill. And so we have no concern about doing things in open session that will be fighting with each other or quarreling in a partisan way, because our object is all the same, which is to bring out the truth and to legislate in a way that protects the country going forward. And so that's really not a concern for us.
Congressman Adam Schiff of California, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Your hand if you remember this theme song. Yeah, it's from the 1980s cult TV classic 21 Jump Street, and it's performed by one of the show's stars, Holly Robinson Peete, who played Officer Judy Hoffs.
I'm Judy Hoffs. That's okay, honey. My people don't do that anymore.
Classic. In the early 90s, Holly Robinson was hanging with Mr. Cooper as a regular on the ABC series. And she even received a surprise on-set proposal from her NFL quarterback boyfriend, Rodney Peete.
You're the best thing that's ever happened to me in my life. I love you with all my heart.
Yes!
28 years later, Holly and Rodney are still going strong and continuing a family tradition of using celebrity status to contribute to the greater good. In 1997, Holly and her husband Rodney founded the Holly Rod Foundation. And through Holly Rod, she's helped many by bringing awareness and resources for children on the autism spectrum. It was a decision based on her family's journey with their eldest son, RJ. Now, I was aware of Holly's work in this area, but I rarely thought about autism until my family learned our youngest child was also on the autism spectrum. It's been years since that diagnosis, but there's one person in particular that I've always wanted to talk with about it.
My name is Holly Robinson Peete. I'm an actor, author, mom of four.
I wanted to know how she and her family made the decision to speak publicly about her son RJ's autism.
I remember very clearly those days, those early days of the diagnosis. I remember the chaos that ensued. I remember feeling hopeless and helpless. I remember my husband, Rodney Peete, was playing football. He was a quarterback and he was gone and he couldn't process it. And so it was really chaotic. And now people look at me and they go, oh, you're such a great advocate. And you just got the diagnosis and you picked yourself up and started advocating. Well, no, I was a hot mommy mess in the beginning. It wasn't until probably when RJ was more like 8 or 9 that I was really able to talk about it and process what autism was and advocate publicly. I did that because I didn't see anybody else doing it. And I knew and was aware of other quote unquote celebrity or famous people who had children on the spectrum, but were hiding it or didn't want to talk about it. And I knew that I could affect change in the autism community by having a public conversation. So we sat down around a table, quite literally, and presented our cases. My husband was not for it. He did not want his son, I labeled as the quarterback and actress's son who, you know, had autism and, you know, he just did not want that for his life. But I really knew because I wasn't seeing any representation in the media or anybody really advocating, I really knew that we had to do it. So we really did a pro and versus con situation, and I won because I win all the arguments in my family. So that just comes with the territory. But quite frankly, it was really a very, very thought out process that we did. And I'm so glad we did, because now I look up all these years later and I see the advocacy we've been able to do and the awareness we've been able to raise. And I'm so glad. But those early days were really difficult. But in the end, sharing is really important. When people see what you're going through, it helps them feel less alone.
I am so personally grateful that you did. My daughter, my eldest is 19, nearly 20, but our little one is 7, and we received the autism spectrum diagnosis, I guess maybe 2.5, 3 years old. And that sense of chaos that you talk about, for me, I think it was less chaos and more denial. My husband actually was the one who was like, oh, good, now we have a thing, you know, now we'll form the team, now we'll just sort of, you know, move forward and doing all the supporting. And I was like, are they sure? Are you serious? I mean, is that really what it is? Couldn't it be something else? Maybe this is racism. Like, quite literally, I was prepared to call it any other thing.
Right. I'm so glad you shared that with me. I didn't know that. And I think that I'm glad you shared that portion of it, because a lot of times the dads get sort of put in this corner of being the parent that always immediately goes into denial. Now, that did happen to be the case with my husband. He did. He was stressed about how his son wasn't going to be the next Heisman Trophy winner and wasn't going to follow in his footsteps. And when he would come to the football games, he would, you know, stem and flap and twirl. And, you know, he just wasn't engaged. And it was hard for Rodney Peete. Like, he was just devastated by this diagnosis. So he was a little paralyzed by it. So I did become the gangster mom and rolled up my sleeves and just like went to battle for this kid. But I still was in a little bit of denial myself, but I was more focused on, you know, getting that intervention early. And like your daughter, my son was diagnosed around 3 years old, but I knew it too, and really just couldn't get the diagnosis. There was a lot of denial going on with my pediatrician and my husband, and they kind of teamed up, and it was a whole thing. But in hindsight, I'm just, you know, I'm really, really glad that he came around and really understood that I needed him on Team RJ.
You know, oh, so interesting you call it Team RJ. We call our crew of supporters Team Anna. And we, you know, we have these sort of regular meetings, and they're, you know, they're always on my Google Calendar as Team Anna. And interestingly enough, it's in part because one of the things I learned about how her autism manifests is that she really knows who's on her side and who's not. And she don't really truck with folks who are not Team Anna. She is down for the people who are down for her. But let me say, part of why the diagnosis was so difficult for me is it's as though someone tells you there's a thing, but it's not a thing. There isn't. My bet is that RJ and Anna are as different from one another as they are from, you know, typical processing kids. And I'm wondering sort of how, as maybe we're talking to other parents who are first getting this diagnosis, how they can think about getting to know their child and not just a diagnosis.
Yeah. So the first thing I tell parents, and I talk to a lot of parents when they're first getting the diagnosis, is to kick in those teams, right? Team Anna, Team RJ, start those now, early on. Just, and they don't have to be family, because sometimes family doesn't get it, Melissa. Sometimes they just don't get it. So it can just be people that can be in his or her corner, because as you grow older, you need to develop a community for them. You know, that said, you're right. If autism is the hardest part about trying to explain it to my friends and my family is that it is a spectrum disorder. So the kids are going to be so vastly different in so many ways. But the one thing that they do share in common, mostly I find, is the social piece, is the inability or the difficulty in having friends and, you know, really just moving in the world in a way that, you know, everybody looks at and doesn't comment on. So that was part of my journey, was to try to normalize neurodiversity, you know, mm-hmm. trying to normalize the fact that not everybody processes everything the same way. And so you're not going to just get, you know, that's what makes us unique. And so that involves people going out of their way to understand who our kids are and how they present themselves into the world. And that's difficult because human beings are interesting. And, you know, kids can be not friendly sometimes, but sometimes they can be pretty amazing. So the battle has been constantly, you know, guarding this boy's heart. And now that he's 24, you know, trying to establish some sort of some sort of independence and a self-identity and self-advocacy, I found out that I was kind of standing in his way a little bit. I had to be the one that, you know, my husband had to call me off and just say, you know, you got to let him go. You got to let him fail. You got to, you know, stop being his bodyguard. And that was hard for me to do. But once I did it, I did notice some great things happening to him. But, you know, as moms, our job is to protect our kids. And so we're on it, you know, we're on it 24/7.
And of course, RJ is not your only son. You are the gangster mom times four. Talk to me about how sort of jumping into action, parenting RJ, being focused on doing the work to create the team that is necessary, also affected, impacted, maybe improved or made more difficult some of the work of parenting your other kids.
Oh boy, that's the part, you know, I don't have a lot of regrets in our autism journey, our 20-year autism journey, but I do wish I had. RJ has a twin sister. So I do wish I had given her a little bit more one-on-one attention so that she was not sort of identified or as being his sister, the neurotypical twin, the one that doesn't have autism. That now she's just graduated from college and now she's, you know, she's feeling the brunt of that now. So I always counsel parents. I say, if you have other kids, make time, find time to just be with them one-on-one, look them in the eye, ask them, don't bring up the affected sibling or the issues that you're having. Don't even say the word autism. Just take your child to the most random place and have an experience that they can call their own that doesn't surround your child with autism. So if I had to go back and do all that again, I probably would have done that differently and been a little bit more patient and kind and understanding, compassionate with his sibling, with his twin sister. Now, the other two are a little bit further apart. So they're, well, now they're 24, 24, 19, and 16. And so they kind of bonded, the two younger ones, but they're amazing advocates for their brother. But they weren't as defined by autism growing up as Ryan, his twin sister, was. So I look at the family as, you know, they're all advocates. They love RJ. They love him in a way that is so strong and so beautiful. And they protect him in a way that is amazing. So they've been, you know, unbelievable members of Team RJ. But I'm always counseling parents to try to incorporate the other siblings, your other kids, in ways that, you know, have less to do with autism. So they're not so defined by that experience.
Now, your industry is entertainment. I first became obsessed with you with, I apologize for bringing this up, but with 21 Jump Street.
Don't apologize for bringing up 21 Jump Street. I'm proud of that show. That show was iconic. And you want to hear something hilarious? It made me just feel so old and irrelevant. But my kids, when the 21 Jump Street movies came out and they asked me to do a cameo in it, my kids' friends were like, why is your mom randomly in this movie? I was like, oh, we'll see. It was about a show first. I love the show and I'm very proud of it. And I walk, you know, I'm not Ginger from Gilligan's Island, who famously never wanted to be called Ginger and hated the show. And, you know, I love 21 Jump Street. I love Judy Hoffs, the character, because at that time, Melissa, there were very few Black women on TV who were in positive roles. She was the only girl on the show and she held her head high and really did some groundbreaking topics on TV that we didn't talk about really too much in the late 80s. So shout out to 21 Jump Street. I'm very proud of that.
For real. I'm so happy that you are, because sometimes people really do hate talking about that early moment, but I loved that show. And I have to say, I am a little bit of a Christmas nerd. So I also watch all the holiday stuff. And I know that part of your work in the entertainment industry, in addition to the foundation work and the advocacy, but within entertainment, has been trying to sort of get the entertainment industry caught up with accurate portrayals of autism and of families who are living with, coping with part of the autism family. So talk to us a little bit about the first Hallmark holiday movie with an autistic character.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so proud of this movie. Our Christmas Journey is a Hallmark Channel Christmas movie, which just recently aired this Christmas season, and it will, like all Hallmark Christmas movies, will run into perpetuity, so everyone can catch it somewhere. But this one is really special. So I've always wanted to do a movie about a family impacted by autism, and I also knew that it was important to have the representation and have the actor have autism or have some connection with autism in a way that they understood the role. And when we found Nick Sanchez, a young 17-year-old actor, you know, his autism is like something that he really wears on his sleeve. He advocates. He's just a phenomenal young man. And I found him through my friends Boris Kojo and Nicole Ari Parker, you know, that ugly couple.
Oh, yeah. They're so funny looking. Yeah,
right. They're just so hard on the eyes, right? They're the most cool, down-to-earth people, and we've been longtime friends forever, and they're just fun and self-deprecating and hilarious. But Boris directed a movie for Lifetime that Nicole starred in, and they called me last spring and said, we found your kid. This kid is in this movie, and he should be in your movie. And so he came on and portrayed this character of Marcus, and the story is really about letting go, right? about Marcus becoming a young man. And we found a place for him to go, which was based on a real place in New York called the Center for Discovery, which is where adults on the autism spectrum will go and learn and be independent and farm the land and eat organically. And it's like a utopian space, but it's a real spot that I'm very familiar with. And so we created this movie about this family dealing with autism from all angles. The parents are divorced, and the father wasn't so much in denial, but he just really struggled raising the son, but was always there to provide for him. Very overzealous mother, played by me, which, you know, was not too hard to do, but always protecting his heart. And then there's a mother character, a grandmother character, who's just awesome, who reminds me of my mom, who was just there for me the whole time. And then the sister was really important. So the sister was really a microcosm of my daughter and other siblings I know, who didn't feel seen. And it was always about their son or their brother with autism. So I love this movie and I'm so excited about it. It is the first major movie role that, in a leading role, that is a character with autism that was played by an actor with autism. I really firmly believe that. Some people have been challenging me in social media, but every time I say, name another actor with autism who's played a role with autism in a leading role, they can't give it back to me. So I'm claiming it for Nick Sanchez, and he has a bright future ahead of him because representation is very important. If we don't see people with autism, if we don't see their experiences and stories told in the media, then we're not going to understand that there's not going to be as much acceptance. For about 4 years, we did a reality show called Meet the Peets, and another version of it was called For Pete's Sake. And it was really about RJ and about our gal rallying around him and helping him through life. And so I've just always wanted to make sure that there was representation and to be able to be an executive producer of Our Christmas Journey and make sure that this role was cast properly was a real blessing.
When you say representation matters, I feel like your departed father, who played the original Gordon on Sesame Street, must be somewhere smiling and saying, yes, that's right. That is the lesson learned. Representation matters. And Sesame Street now has introduced the character of Julia, who has autism.
Oh, my gosh, Melissa, that we talk about a full circle moment. They asked me, Sesame Workshop asked me to come to Capitol Hill and introduce Julia when she first came out. We did a big press conference, and the full circleness of that moment was so powerful that they would ask me to be a part of Julia's unveiling, if you will. And that was just one of the best days of my life because I felt my dad in the room to have started this show, this amazing show. And if anybody is bored and wants to watch TV and see a good documentary, please watch Street Gang. It's about the early days of Sesame Street and really focuses on some of my dad's work and just as an amazing documentary. But you're right. I think he would be very proud of this moment because when he was on Sesame Street starting in 69, we all know what this country was going through. And there was no representation for Black children on television. It's hard to imagine that, but there really wasn't. And the Street Gang is great because it tells the story about my dad, but it also talks about his Muppet, Roosevelt Franklin, who, if people are my age, they will remember Roosevelt, who was really the first Black Muppet my dad created. And just, he was awesome. And so Roosevelt was a little too much for that time. Like, he was ahead of his time. I think they just introduced two new Black Muppet characters on Sesame Street recently. And I they're saying, oh, the first Black characters on Sesame. I said, oh, no, that was Roosevelt back in 69, 70. So anyway, I am so proud of that legacy and the full circleness that Julia is now on. Because if my son had a Julia on TV when he was growing up, that would have been a game changer for his life.
Let me ask this final question, because part of how we'll be framing this conversation is around some of the research, critical research, but research around autism, which sometimes also moves towards the kind of curing or sort of discourse around, well, you know, eventually there'll be a generation where no one will have to, you know, experience a life on autism spectrum disorder. And I have to say, as a parent of an autistic kid, it kind of, I think, actually, I'm not sure that the elimination of autism is at all my goal. There are so many gifts associated with how this kiddo sees the world and how she helps me to see it. So I think that's what I want to try to end here on is, for all the challenges that there are in parenting and navigating for kids who are neurodiverse, what are some of the gifts?
Well, these kids are so amazing and think outside the box and process the world differently and see things differently. And that diversity of thought is so powerful. And when that gets embraced, great things happen. We have a foundation called Holly Rod Foundation. And one of the things that we do and focus on are job placement and job training for young adults and adults on the spectrum. Doesn't have to be a young adult, but adults working age, trying to match them up with corporations who really get their worth and their value. My son, RJ, who was told at 3 that he would never do a whole lot of things. One of the things that the list that she ran down, she said he would never have meaningful employment. And so one of the reasons why I wanted to share RJ's story, and long before he got this amazing job with the Los Angeles Dodgers as a clubhouse attendant, and he got a World Series ring and all those amazing things, long before that even happened, I wanted to share the journey because I believed that would help people see and understand that this is a spectrum and it is a journey. And there are so many beautiful things that they can do. There are amazing gifts. To your point about the curing piece, I just don't like to pass judgment on anybody who's on this mm-hmm. journey, who wants to, you know, it to be eradicated or wanted to be cured, or there was recently a famous autism mom who announced that her son didn't have autism anymore. I felt some kind of way about that personally, but then I had to check myself and say, you know what, if that is that person's journey, that's fine. My journey is to celebrate who these people are and to embrace their autism and not focus on curing it or trying to eradicate it. Embracing their neurodiversity, embracing the way that they are, normalizing their behavior in a lot of ways, not trying to give them the tools to make it through this world, but at the same time, making sure that people understand how beautiful and valuable they are, as God put them on this earth. So it's such an amazing question, Melissa. And I kind of sit in the middle and allowing, I had to get to this point, wasn't always there. I had to work myself up to this point to be a little bit more understanding and compassionate to people who really just want to say, get rid of autism and hopefully it'll never exist. My feeling is that embracing it brings some pretty, pretty cool things. So that would be my thought on that.
Yeah. And compassion for everyone on every part of this journey. That sounds right to me. Holly Robinson Peete, actress, Gangsta Mom times 4. Thank you for joining The Takeaway.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
A lot of people our age aren't interested in commitment. They're only interested in intercourse.
Yeah. Look, it's true.
What I also know is with a lot of girls your age, Liv, when they're still in high school, they only want a boyfriend.
For intercourse.
Not just for intercourse, but also as a bodyguard and as a sugar daddy.
I think every family needs a Michael. It just adds something different.
Now, that is just a little bit of wisdom from Michael Thomas, one of the young adults featured on the Netflix reality series Love on the Spectrum. The series, out of Australia, features young adults living with autism who are navigating the challenges of love and dating for the first time. And unlike many reality dating shows, this one does not thrive on conflict and competition. It's disarming in its sincerity and humanity. It's a show that makes viewers root for every single person involved.
And in that way, Love on the Spectrum is at least a little bit like real-life parenting on the spectrum for families with autistic children. One in every 54 American children is affected by autism spectrum disorder. It's a complex, lifelong condition that manifests quite differently for the millions of people who live on the spectrum. But for nearly everyone with autism, the condition impacts communication, interpersonal relationships, and social interactions. For some with autism, there's no possibility of engaging with a reality TV show because the effects of the autism are severe. Researchers at Washington University are using stem cells to study a rare form of autism linked to a gene mutation. It's a form of autism affecting 16-year-old Jake Litvag. And WashU researchers bred mice that mimic Jake's exact gene mutation in order to better understand the disorder. Dr. Joseph Dougherty is professor of genetics and psychiatry at Washington University in St. Louis. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you. Dr. Dougherty, let's just start with how this research project got started. Talk to us a little bit about Jake and his family.
Yeah, this whole story really starts with that family. It's very family-centric. So 16 years ago, the Litvag family had a child who was later diagnosed with autism. He developed more slowly than his peers. It was late to a lot of developmental milestones. And like a lot of families, I think they, you know, initially it was quite a challenge to understand what was going on and why it happened. But as time went on, they connected with a good clinical colleague of mine, John Constantino, who's one of the preeminent autism clinicians here in St. Louis and nationwide. And as they met him and came to know him, he talked to them about the possibility of doing genetic testing to try and understand what the causes were for Jake's autism. Autism, it turns out, is very strongly genetic. There's, you know, if you look at twins, identical twins who have autism, if one has autism, it's very likely that the other one will also have autism. And this means that genes play a strong influence in the disease. But the question is, which genes and how? So with their family, as sequencing costs have dropped in the last 10 years, they, like many others, have been able to get their child's genome, or at least the protein portion of the genome, the exome, sequenced. And they found that he had this rare mutation in a gene called MYT1L, or MYT1L.
For those of us who are not genetic researchers, remind us what it means to say that one could have your gene sequenced.
Oh, since the Human Genome Project 20 years ago, scientists have been developing technology to read out base by base every letter of your genome. So the genome is a 3 billion base pair string, so 3 billion letters of A, T, C, or G. And the sequence of that is what provides the instructions for different proteins that build your body. And now that sequencing costs have dropped, you can kind of look through each of everyone's 3 billion bases and try and identify those where they might differ from the general population. So with Jacob, this is relatively painless these days. You can, you know, swish some saliva and pick up some cheek cells and extract DNA from those, which is a painless procedure, and then sequence that in the laboratory and identify places where your sequence might differ from the general population.
Okay, so it doesn't surprise me to learn, especially when we're talking about billions, right, that there are genes and particular sequences that would be associated, particularly across a broad spectrum like the autism spectrum. But I'm wondering, what have you discovered in terms of which genes or which genes sequences are most likely to be associated with autism?
So there are these 3 billion bases in the genome, but only 1% of that actually codes for the instructions to make proteins. I often think of it, my kids love Legos. So the genome is the instruction for every Lego that the manufacturer might make, you know, 20,000 different little possible pieces that could be made. But a particular cell in the body only uses sort of a little fraction of those. You know, if you're buying the pirate ship Lego kit, you get the little cannons, you get the little sails, the hatches, those kinds of things. And some of those little square blocks that are in everything. When you get this spaceship kit, you have like little laser blasters and jet thrusters and pilot seats, but also still some of those same little blocks. So of these 20,000 genes, different ones are different, used in different parts of the body. What we do when we're sequencing is we look at the instructions for each block and try and see how are those different from one to the next. Now, the challenge is there's 20,000 different genes, and it turns out that copying all 3 billion bases especially that very first time they need to do it, you know, right after the egg is fertilized, biology sometimes makes some mistakes. It sometimes miscopies one of those bases. And a lot of times it doesn't matter. There's 3 billion bases. There's a lot of surrounding material. Only 1% of it is really coding for those blocks. But once in a while, strike a lightning event, you hit something important. So to sequence the genome, we kind of try to look for those events where we see a certain base has been mutated as a field. Then what we try and do is sequence large collections of children with autism or intellectual disability. And we look for the times that we're seeing the same block hit over and over again. I mean, we're fortunate. There's like 2 copies of every gene in your body. You get one from your mom and one from your dad. So sometimes taking, you know, one hit doesn't really matter. The other one can compensate for it. But there are some genes where that appears not to be the case. And just getting one mutation can disrupt you. And the way we tell is we just look and try and look for those mutations. We're seeing more in kids in autism than in uninfected children. Often we're using their siblings as controls because we know those kids grew up in the same environment, on the same sort of genetic background and ancestry. Yet they're not showing traits of autism. So if we see mutations in those kids, we know that those are sort of ones that happen by chance and probably aren't damaging compared to the ones with the kids, with the siblings with autism.
So Dr. Dougherty, you've been sort of talking with us through genes, through gene sequencing and understanding how these genetic expressions, I love the Lego visual there, can help us to understand which genes are related to autism. So talk to me about the mice.
Sure. So Jake has a really rare form of autism. You know, as sequencing became cheap enough to sequence lots of different kids with autism, you know, initially we thought we'd always known autism was a genetic disease, but the field thought that maybe there'd be a few dozen autism genes. But as they started doing these experiments, what they found was that there are probably hundreds of different genes that can cause autism. But each one of these is hitting a very small fraction of kids. If you add them all up on the whole, there's maybe 10 or 20% of autism is caused by these strike of lightning events. But each type is maybe, you know, initially in the initial discovery studies might've been 2 or 5 kids. And now maybe worldwide at this point, as sequencing's gone on, we've found about 100 with Jake's mutation as an example. So the challenge there is really understanding what that gene does. What we can kind of look at it and look at similar genes and try and guess what it might be involved in, but there's so many genes in the genome and many of them have not been that well studied before. And with looking at the kids, you know, one thing that clinicians will do is they'll look at a series of kids and try and find the commonalities across all of them. So with Jake's gene mutation in MIT1L, you very often see that the kids have developmental delay, a slow motor development, kind of a lack of coordination, some intellectual disability, sometimes autism, sometimes slightly smaller brains, and maybe a tendency towards hyperactivity and obesity. But we don't know which of those traits really come from the gene and which might have been coincidence. There's plenty of kids that get hyperactivity but don't have autism and don't have this gene, for example. So would Jake have gotten that diagnosis even without this mutation? The advantage of trying to make a mouse that models that mutation is it lets us really figure out what traits in biological traits are a consequence of that gene mutation and do it in a well-controlled and well-powered way. You know, each kid with this mutation also grows up in a different environment. They're all different ages by the time the clinician sees them. But with mice, we can generate a lot of individual animals that have an identical mutation, live in the same environment, and really study in a very controlled way the biological consequences.
All right, so that's super helpful for me. And obviously, as a university researcher, you know, much of your work is what we would call a basic research or core science, right? Trying to understand things in order to understand them. But I also, you know, I'm the parent of a child on the autism spectrum, and I'm wondering what the end goal of the research is, because I know that for many of us in autism community, we don't want a cure in the sense of I wouldn't take away any, you know, as much as I want to support my daughter in navigating a neurotypical world, I also don't wish her to be any other kind of way. So talk to me a little bit about what learning this about the genetics of autism and of autism expression, what it does for us as it becomes applied research.
I love that question. I mean, first, I agree with you. Sort of the decision of what and how to treat is entirely up to the patients and their families. I think my goal as a basic science researcher is to provide the understanding of what happens so that there's an opportunity to treat for some things if if it makes sense for you. And I think that's going to vary a lot with each different form of autism. I mean, I think there's few parents that wouldn't want to treat epilepsy, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Or some of those challenges that really make their children's lives hard. So what we hope to do is provide a deeper understanding of how this mutation causes this phenotype in the brain. Like, what does it do to brain development that results in this, to give people the opportunity to potentially intervene if they want to? But I think that's really a decision for the families.
Now, one of the things that your research seems to have discovered here is that this gene, this sort of missing gene, does not seem to shorten life, that these mice that are little versions of Jake actually live normal mice lives in terms of longevity. Tell me why that's significant.
Oh, I mean, so, you know, the amazing thing about this project was it really started from the family and that they supported the early stage of the research. And, you know, they came from a community that had resources. And when they heard from John about the mutation their child had, they asked, you know, who's doing research on this? And there were really very few people working on it at that time. But he suggested he knew some people who might be able to do some basic discovery of what the gene does and help out. But the challenge is that while the federal government funds a lot of biomedical research, they're relatively risk averse. They want to make sure the tax dollars are very well spent. And so given a suite of different projects to choose from, they're always going to choose the lowest risk one with the highest success rate, which is great. But the making a new mouse line for something is a risky proposition. There's a lot of steps in there that may or may not work on the first try. So the family was able to, with the help of friends and family of theirs, gather enough funding to support both our work and the work of Chris Kroll in making some stem cell models to help develop it for this disease. So they supported the early stage research to be able to generate the mouse for us, to fund our generation and characterization of the mouse. So, you know, this has been about a 2 or 3 year journey, and we were able to do the risky parts with their support, and from that then apply to government foundations to support our work to continue and actually characterize these mice and understand their consequences and test a variety of therapeutics. What I was, I was taught by my grandmother to always be polite and write thank you notes. And so as this went along, I was always writing letters through my clinical colleague to them just to kind of update them on how things are going. You know, like, hey, we got the mouse. It looks like it's working. And, oh, hey, we started to evaluate the mice and they have, you know, it was, you know, I was talking about the features of MIT1L, how the kids are often hyperactive and a little obese and have motor difficulties. And we took a set of mice and we compared them to their sibling mice that didn't have the mutation. And we put them like on a little American Ninja Warrior course and had them do little kind of little tasks of climbing a pole and run down a ledge. And just like the children, they were a little bit clumsier than their siblings and they were a little more hyperactive. And they even tended to be a little more obese, especially in the early generations. So I was going along and updating them with each of these things. But I knew one big question for them was lifespan, because a lot of these rare genetic mutations that affect the brain also affect other organs. They might affect heart development or lungs, like Williams syndrome. Those children often have severe cardiac defects that, if not treated, can really shorten their lifespan. So with our first set of mice, we just let them age out and let them live there as long as a mouse can, which is about 2 or 3 years. And there was this moment a month ago where for the first time, we actually met the family. They came into the lab, Jake came in to meet his mouse and meet his stem cells that have been modeled along with him. And he brought along his brother and his parents. And it was really a wonderful chance to tell them at that moment that it seems like, as far as we can tell, these mice live like a normal lifespan. You know, they really don't seem to have anything that's cutting them short. And I think as an early thing to learn from the mice, that was like kind of a great thing to be able to deliver that news to them.
It absolutely is. Dr. Joseph Docherty is a professor of genetics and psychiatry at Washington University in St. Louis. Dr. Docherty, thank you so much for this research and for your time today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I've really enjoyed speaking with you.
That's all we have for you today. We really hope you enjoyed our show. But before I go, I want to send a big old congrats to the Georgia Bulldogs, the college football national champions. Go Dogs! And public schools are reopening in Chicago on Wednesday, so we're hoping for healthy and happy educators and students all across the country. Call us with show ideas or suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Come on back here with me tomorrow.